This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've walked your snow-capped mountains.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is November 26, 2020, and this is episode 217.
I'm Scott DeLundebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we do a deep dive into the new BC cabinet. First, thank you to the 100 people who contribute every month, and thank you to Stuart Prest for stepping in last week. I had a family emergency of sorts. Everything's fine, but it was nice to be able to rely on talented, smart people like Stuart to be able to step up and fill my shoes. If you want to help keep this show going, go to patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is also in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Well, let's kick it off. It's a kind of status quo cabinet. What are your top level takes from the cabinet of John Horgan that was announced today?
I think the only real surprise is I didn't expect finance to go to the person who it did. I should say also, I didn't really have much in the way of strong priors and what I was really expecting out of this cabinet. The only other thing that really stood out to me, at least on first glance, is that not all of the high-profile former MPs got top-level cabinet positions, which I was expecting. There's a couple that ended up as either parliamentary secretaries or ministers of state.
Yeah, really only Murray Rankin made it into cabinet. And even there, he wasn't given like the AG portfolio that some people were talking about. Pretty much most of the major portfolios, as far as I could tell, stayed in the same hands. David Eby didn't move out of AG. Adrian Dix is still in health. Mike Farnworth is still Solicitor General. So people who were happy and seemed to be doing well largely stayed where they were.
I don't think you can move the health minister without it being a huge deal. Dix was pretty much going to be in his position regardless. That was the one cabinet position I 100% expected to stay the same.
I think the biggest top-level move is that Rob Fleming left education and is now in charge of transportation.
Selena Robinson went from municipal affairs and housing to finance.
Let's maybe dig into this in order, alphabetically, somewhat from the list of the ministries. We won't go through every single minister and parliamentary secretary, but to note some of the changes and some of the key interesting things that we pulled out of the mandate letters. John Horgan's the premier. I think one of the first things, though, I noticed was there's no deputy premier, which as far as I could tell is our first time not having a deputy premier for 30, 40 years. Like, we've had deputy premiers since at least the 80s, late 80s.
Yeah, I suppose that's a little odd. But on the other hand, like, deputy premier really has no constitutional significance at all. So the fact that there isn't a post on that, just not a huge amount to say on that. And these days, the second in command is often more the chief of staff than another minister.
It's worth noting that Carol James, the outgoing deputy premier and finance minister, has been appointed a special advisor at the serious cost of $1 per year to John Horgan. And I guess anyone in cabinet who wants to hear from her. Overall, I think that's probably a very good thing for this government. She's smart, well-respected, did really well in finance in a tough situation. And so the fact she's willing to still help this government out is probably promising. She's probably not still deputy premier, though. That would be really weird.
Yeah, like, there isn't a formal requirement that anyone in cabinet be elected, but there's an unofficial rule for that, and it would be just really weird to have the deputy premier not be one of those people.
Let's start at the top of the alphabet. The Attorney General, as we mentioned, is David Eby. He also now picks up the role as the Minister responsible for housing. His other mandates include things that aren't very surprising, working on the justice portfolio, working towards decriminalization of personal possession of drugs, along with the Solicitor General and Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, which is what the NDP promised in the election by pushing Ottawa to change the criminal code. But what I found interesting in there is that in the absence of prompt federal action, it writes, the minister will develop a made in BC solution that will help save lives. Conveniently, the public health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, wrote a made in BC solution a few years ago and presented it to cabinet, to which they went, that's a nice report. We'll put it on the shelf.
It's a pleasant surprise to see a government that's actually willing to not just play endless rounds of federalism on buck passing to other levels of government. So, yeah, the refreshing change to see that, even if it is a little suspect on the grounds that the criminal code is exclusively a federal jurisdiction.
The other stuff that he's continuing to work on, money laundering. On the housing side, he's got a few things. Basically, it's continuing the work the NDP had been doing on their housing plan, implementing the rent freeze they promised, implementing a homelessness strategy, updating the building code to be more accessible, and together with the Minister of Finance, fixed the strata insurance dumpster fire. David Eby's always been the Minister of Dumpster Fires, and he no longer has to deal with ICBC. That got moved over to Mike Farnworth because I guess it's not on fire anymore. It's just smoldering. But strata insurance is definitely a red hot mess.
Overall, I wasn't too happy to see housing get tacked on to the Attorney General role. Outside of, you know, the current COVID situation, housing was one of the most pressing issues in the province, and we're still a long way from really solving it. And it's not a great sign that it gets appended as an afterthought to the Attorney General. And I know there's the argument that David Eby's a high profile cabinet minister. Some of the other stuff that got tacked onto his portfolio last term, there was decent resolution on. But regardless, being an attorney general is a full-time job, and nothing really is going to change that. And there's only a finite amount of hours that any minister can spend on anything, and that simply means there has to be trade-offs there, and it would be much better to see either a dedicated ministry for housing, or rather than that, if it is going to be split and with another ministerial responsibility, at least be something that properly overlaps it, like back when it was in with municipal affairs.
Early in his mandate, Eby took a lot of heat and was accidentally, in a way, the point person on some of the controversial taxes the NDP brought in, the empty homes tax, the speculation and vacancy tax, or not the empty homes tax, on the speculation and vacancy tax and on the school tax surcharge, particularly because he represents a riding with a lot of people who got hit by that mansion tax. And so I think he has been seen, and he has done actually a lot of advocacy for housing issues for his constituents. So I see why he was chosen for this personally. Like, I get the argument that the Attorney General is a very busy office, but Eby's somewhat proved himself to be able to handle and juggle a lot of big issues. Remember that he also did the electoral reform referendum in his last mandate on top of everything else he was saddled with. And we can just...
Yeah, which, if I recall, failed. We do not have electoral reform.
He did
now.
Run a referendum, whether we think it was done well or not.
There was significant complaints that the NDP did not put sufficient resources into ensuring the referendum passed.
And that was the split within the party itself. My point is just that he managed to address that as well as starting the money laundering inquiry, which was not even on his agenda before, the ICBC stuff, and as well as the main meat and potatoes of the Attorney General role. So I think of all the ministers, of all the individuals who could take this on, I can see why EB would take it. And I think it may even have been a personal desire of his to work on this. The other thing is a lot of the housing issues in BC, as the government sees them, are just continuing what they'd been working on. They didn't promise to do much more beyond what had been already put in the works through the housing plan and the work being done by the housing hub. We can think that's not enough, but a lot of the mandate letters just refer to things that were promised in the platform.
Regardless, those are all fair points, but it still fundamentally doesn't change the fact that when you put an "and" minister responsible for whatever onto it, they will never be able to dedicate the amount of resources, time, and attention that a dedicated ministry would have. And the way governments often signal something, say priority, is not rather than tacking onto someone else who has a full-time job, is create a dedicated ministry like they did back with the Ministry for Mental Health and Addictions. And that was a very clear sign back in 2017 that the NDP wanted to make it a priority, whereas this definitely does not.
For sure. That. If you ask 1,000 British Columbians, I suspect you would not see housing at the level of priority that it was even a year ago. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't address it. I agree. But there is a political calculus that in terms of short-term priorities, for now, they can maybe backburner it, unfortunately. I'm eager to move on, though. There's a lot of other ministers to talk about. The other element of the Attorney General's portfolio, though, is his parliamentary secretary is Roshna Singh, who will be responsible for anti-racism initiatives. And this kind of flows through all of the mandate letters, which is that anti-racism is going to be a key component of the approach that this whole government wants to take. And Singh will be responsible for reviewing anti-racism laws in other jurisdictions and consulting with stakeholders and helping introduce an anti-racism act for British Columbia, as well as finding other legislation that might be necessary to reduce discrimination and permit race-based data collection in both the health and education system, something that many people have pointed out we've been severely lacking in COVID. So that'll be interesting to see. Moving to the next ministries, some of the new moves around Anne Kang, my MLA, actually. She is now the Minister of Advanced Education, Skills and Training, responsible largely for implementing the promises in the NDP's platform on post-secondary education, so we won't dwell on that. Lana Popham stays in agriculture. Lisa Baer is the new Minister of Citizen Services. Mitzi Dean is the new Minister of Children and Family Development. Together with Katrina Chen, the Minister of State for Childcare, they'll continue to roll out Childcare BC. And the new Minister of Education is Jennifer Whiteside. I mentioned Rob Fleming moved out of that role, probably to the cheering of many teachers in the BCTF who found him to be unimpressive in the role. Though his record is arguably pretty good, he did manage to negotiate a new collective agreement with teachers. And hell, any education minister who doesn't have a strike on their hands probably gets a pass in this province.
Yeah, that's always a potential flashpoint that didn't actually flash into anything. So yeah, in that respect, it's like Veterans Affairs federally. Like, it's very hard to be a success in that role where you're generating a lot of good news, but just not generating bad news can be its own mark of success.
Whiteside's interesting. She comes from the Health Employees Union, and I've already seen a BCTF tweet congratulating her on the appointment, which I would hope the union would congratulate the minister, even if they didn't necessarily agree. It'll be interesting to see how she works with the BCTF, given that her own background is in a large labor organization. So that'll be, you know, one I'm watching going forward. There wasn't anything that jumped out in her mandate letter beyond what the NDP had already been doing on education. She will be working with the previous Ministry of Childcare to bring childcare into the Ministry of Education by the end of the NDP's 4 years. And of course, how she deals with COVID over the next few weeks and months, particularly as teachers face a potential shift to whatever previous phase where maybe it's half online or maybe in-class instruction is suspended. She's going to have a lot on her plate very soon, undoubtedly.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch her, because one area the NDP is traditionally vulnerable on is being seen as being overly chummy with public sector unions. So how that relationship plays out could potentially be a weak point. But there isn't going to be a contract negotiation up front until, I think, 2022. It should spare them for a little bit on that.
The next change is not a change in the minister, but a change in the ministry. The former Ministry of Energy, Mines and Petroleum, Resources is now the Ministry of Energy, Mines and Low Carbon Innovation. Bruce Ralston is still in that role. It's interesting to see petroleum resources dropped and low carbon innovation swapped in, especially when the mandate letter contains nothing about LNG or liquefied natural gas. The NDP had promised to keep going on the LNG project they're working on, and now that's disappeared from the language. Instead, Ralston has a lot of language in his mandate letter about clean BC, expanding zero emission vehicle usage, establishing this BC Center for Innovation and Clean Energy, and even undertaking a review of oil and gas royalty credits to ensure we're getting our fair return.
All more or less expected. LNG entirely disappearance, somewhat noteworthy. Not a huge fan of changing the name, but whenever these ministries actually change the name, it always feels very in your face, that banging you over the head with the point they want to make, especially on this one with like low carbon innovation, which just feels so buzzwordy. And especially because, like, yes, a fair bit of innovation is needed to address climate change, but there's also a lot of low-hanging fruit that we could start to implement on immediately that doesn't require a huge amount of innovation, that they aren't exactly rushing ahead with as quickly as they could be.
Getting the words petroleum resources out of the name of the ministry is a positive step for a government that's trying to champion a clean BC plan. So at that minimum, whether they needed to put low carbon innovation or something else in, fine. I get it with how they're trying to frame this. The shift is notable, though, considering the amount of criticism the NDP has taken from its base and the Greens on LNG. The other controversial aspect of Ralston's portfolio is Site C. And rather than make sure it goes ahead, he is tasked with drawing on the findings of the independent review, ensure the cost and schedule pressures facing it are addressed in a manner that protects the best interest of British Columbians, which is super vague.
The way I read that is make sure it goes ahead without being very upfront that they're going to go ahead with it. But yeah, also, like, it's not the entire NDP base. It's the, you know, urban progressive part of the NDP base rather than the kind of blue-collar trade union part of the NDP base that is much more the anti-LNG, anti-Site C contingent. Next up is environment and climate change strategy, as well as the minister responsible for TransLink, George Heyman. So his mandates include pretty much what you'd expect, the Clean BC targets, supporting the Mayor's Council stuff. Now, what I don't particularly like about this is moving TransLink out of the Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure. Yes, TransLink does have, and transit in general, does have environmental and climate benefits, but they really are secondary to transit's main function, which is to get people around, connect people throughout a city. And in that respect, moving it out of transportation and into environment really feels like taking your eye off the ball of what transit's core function is.
So I think you need a minister or at least an MLA who's based in Metro Vancouver to head TransLink. Doesn't make sense for Rob Fleming out of Victoria to be the minister responsible for TransLink. And given that Bowen Ma has been promoted to the Minister of State for Infrastructure, she can't also hold the TransLink parliamentary secretary. So you have the choice of either creating another parliamentary secretary to focus on TransLink and handing that to one of, and there are a number of MLAs in Metro Van who could have held that.
Also, they went from, I think it was 7 to 13 parliamentary, they were handing them out like candy.
So there's more people to reward.
Yeah. The point is, you can find some, if you're handing out that many new parliamentary secretary positions, you can find someone to do TransLink.
Now, I do think there is some justifiable overlap between expanding transit support through the 10-year plan and through expanding the network and climate change and environment. I think this ultimately just means Heyman and Fleming are going to be working pretty closely together on a lot of these issues.
Yeah, undoubtedly that'll be the case, but I still think it's important to understand what your primary objective here is, and when you look at it as a environmental strategy rather than a transportation method, it really feels like it's a little out of place and kind of overemphasizing the secondary benefits rather than its main function here. The one that I do like in the mandate letter about this is that when they're discussing the need to continue to build out the SkyTrain expansions, including the Broadway one, it's very clear that the eventual terminus is going to be UBC.
All going to take money from the feds.
The province could be a little quicker with the money that's coming on this and being a little more aggressive on that. But I think that's a good moment to segue to the next minister, which is finance and Selena Robinson. So this one was a bit of a surprise for me. She was okay as Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing, but I wasn't wowed enough to be thinking, oh, yeah, she should definitely be the person to fill Carol James's shoes and take on what's arguably the most important ministry.
I'd heard her name tossed around as a possible finance minister a few times before she was appointed today. Like you, I wasn't sure that was the best fit for her. She was a previous city councilor in Coquitlam, family therapist before entering politics. Critics for municipal affairs, but I also don't think she flubbed it in a horrible way. That's not a huge endorsement, but it may have also been a situation of, yeah, if like, not I, her, who? Like, I don't know actually who else I would have picked.
I definitely would have given her a passing grade, but not really high one for that. Yeah, there isn't an obvious alternate if you're keeping EB and Dix in there. Portfolios. Still, finance isn't exactly the ministry you want to be doing there's no one else around for. But regardless, the mandate lever covers a lot of what you'd expect, getting out the recovery benefit, the renter's rebate, which will be income tested, also a recovery investment fund to deliver 1% of GDP to new capital projects, which when you do the math, works out to about $2.5 billion in that range, which, I mean, yeah, that's good, but there are single projects that we could really use that are in the billion-dollar range. And with interest rates being what they are, 1% of GDP seems a little unambitious on that, particularly as you're going into what could be a long recovery out of the COVID-induced economic troubles.
I understood that as per year, though. And when you look at those larger products, yeah, each year. And so when you look at a larger project like the Broadway subway, that's a project that'll take 4 or 5 years probably to build. And so the amount to invest in it, if you're investing $2.5 billion a year, and hope in some of the larger projects, finding matches from the federal government and local government, that is a lot of money. Like, what was the BC Liberal infrastructure pledge? $8 billion over 3 years?
Yes.
So this is about that. So it's a decent amount. And if it becomes a permanent thing, and that's on top of existing capital commitments, and their existing capital commitments include like the Langley SkyTrain. So this could see a lot of additional projects. I'm pretty up on this. I'm pretty pro this investment fund.
I'm not against it. I just think it, you know, 1.5% may have been a target I would have liked to have seen, or even two.
All right, fair enough. There's some other stuff in here. Reestablishing the government film sector task force. Film has obviously been hit pretty hard by COVID, especially the border restrictions. The end PST on e-bikes, which I think it came out that was Bo and Ma's like pet project to get into the platform. So that'll be nice to see. And there was a weird one in here that the Minister of Finance will assume responsibility for property assessment and oversight of BC assessment. I don't quite know exactly what's going on there. Are you up on that?
That I'm not entirely sure. I think assessment might currently fall under municipal affairs. I mean, I'm not actually sure on that necessarily. But I also don't know why they'd be wanting to.
Maybe it's
to
just
move
following
that in that
Selena Robinson
case. Maybe, but I don't know. I didn't hear enough about that there was some really important reason why that needed to follow her. It's probably on Crown Corp.
Also with municipal affairs, Selena Robinson will be working to help provide relief for commercial tenants with triple net leases who are paying high property taxes, and also working to bring down the cost of housing for people by streamlining and modernizing housing construction and approvals. That was the cut the red tape part of the NDP platform that I think was a little surprising, given that it was written in language more familiar probably to BC Liberals than the NDP's own base.
Yeah, that's really welcome to see that the language in the platform was surprising. It was very much written like it was aimed to appeal to me rather than the typical NDP voter.
It just wasn't offended.
I'm not going
to
complain about
voters.
That at
all. There weren't any who are like, I want antiquated and awkward approval processes in my municipality.
I think you are drastically underestimating how much sentiment there would be for a fuck the developers.
Oh yeah, you can phrase it like that, but you can't phrase it like
platform blank.
If you just say let's streamline housing approvals, people will be like, yeah, whatever. I think that's how most saw it.
Yeah, it's a, you know, one step removed. The inverse of that would be popular.
Robinson will also be working with Parliamentary Secretary on Gender Equity, Grace Lohr, who's the new MLA for Victoria Beacon Hill, I believe, who replaces Carol James. And gender equity is another element that flows through all of the ministerial mandates.
Yeah, it's a little surprising that that one also doesn't report to the Attorney General the way the Parliamentary Secretary
One of the things
for anti-racism
I saw in the gender equity mandate is that Lohr will be responsible for ensuring that Crown corporations and public appointments have gender equity considerations in them, so that there are, and setting targets for public sector organizations to meet gender equity. So I think some of that is a little more related to finance, or maybe even citizen services, than some of the other ministers, than like Attorney General. Although I believe the Parliamentary Secretary for Gender Equity will also be responsible for recommending ways to improve BC's laws to be less sexist. The next new appointment to cabinet is, or the next move in cabinet is Katrine Conroy is the new Forest, Lands, Natural Resource Operations and Rural Development Minister, the minister with the longest ministry name. But I think the main interesting thing in her mandate letter is that her job will be to help carve up her ministry with the her Minister of State for Lands, Natural Resource Operations, Nathan Cullen. The goal is to give him a real ministry, but he doesn't have one yet. They gave him a Minister of State and said, we will aim to get you a real ministry. So it sounds like they gave him training wheels, possibly as a little slap on the wrist for his performance during the campaign, which was not clean.
Yeah, this feels very much a subtle slight towards, or maybe not even that subtle, towards Nathan Cullen. If you'd, September 1, if you'd looked and said, okay, what is Nathan Cullen's likely role in this government? I don't think anyone would have said Minister of State for Lands and Natural Resource Operations. It very much like feels like a demotion relative to kind of the
Minister
expected path.
Of Lands and Natural Resource Operations, that I can see making sense for him. He represents a northern riding, a large one. That's a lot of land. There are some natural resource projects in his riding. He's worked with the Wet'suwet'en around the Coastal GasLink pipeline issues there. And so he has some touch base on natural resource operations. That fit is okay. But yeah, making it a Minister of State with the goal of becoming a minister is a very unique form of punishment.
So the other interesting thing buried in the Forestry Lands Natural Resource Operations and World of... Wow, that really is a mouth. I can see why they want to split up for no other reason than to save printing costs on the stationery.
The acronym is FLNORORD, whereas others are like, you don't even have an acronym for health, or it's HL.
That is an initialism that is already too complicated to work through. But yeah, buried in there and a couple of other related ministries is expanding... I think they call it high-speed connectivity, which one assumes means fast internet, but isn't actually spelled out as that, which is good. How that actually gets accomplished isn't exactly clear, because telecoms are federally regulated. There isn't a BC Crown Corp that does telecoms. So what exactly that means?
It's a perpetual thing that...
So they'll have to be figured out.
Governments at the provincial and federal level have been promising for a while that we will get high-speed internet or high-speed connectivity to remote and rural regions with incremental kind of delivery. I think largely it's been subsidies and preferential treatment for the big three telecoms to set fiber optic up. Establishing a Crown Corp to do it would be very efficient and very NDP. I'm not that optimistic.
No, they absolutely should. Telecoms is one of those things where I tend to be full on just nationalize the damn thing, because it really functions as a national monopoly in a lot of ways, or even in the best case scenarios, a uncompetitive oligopoly of a couple major firms that you don't really get any of the benefits that market competition actually delivers in so many other sectors. And so you might as well just do it. It's, like I said earlier, it's super cheap to borrow for long term. It really is a critical piece of infrastructure for the 21st century economy. Just do it. Make a splash. There's no reason not to do it other than being a little gun-shy.
Speaking of feeling a little gun-shy over in the Ministry of Health, Adrian Dix is obviously responsible still for COVID, providing free vaccines to everyone. But the big thing in his portfolio is going to be continuing to clean up long-term care. And some of this has started with COVID, but it was during the election campaign where the Greens really staked out the, we'll go to 100% public long-term care. And the NDP was like, we'll get it to be a little bit less privatized and make it a little more stable work. And that's where they're still aiming. They've been doing good work on there. It's a long, complicated problem, as I think we've talked about a few times in the past. Dick seems like he knows what he's doing on the files, though, at least.
And because of that, there was absolutely no way they'd move him in the middle of such a major public health crisis. If he'd been constant screw-ups, which... Yeah, I think you make a pretty solid case that post first wave BC's responses being a little subpar at the very least. But like, there aren't obvious bad decisions that were made that necessitate, you know, a change in leadership in health. So because of that, any change would, you know, be such a strong signal that the government had screwed something up, that there was no way they were going to move him. His
so
job
long as he still wanted it.
Very safe.
Like he did. You're cuffed to that
desk. Even if he didn't want it, if you're sitting around the premier's office or zooming with your colleagues at the premier's office in a socially distant manner, I can't see the discussion leading any way, but you gotta just give it to him if he's going to be in cabinet. There isn't, if he asked for something else, he just got to say no and keep him in health.
Dix will also be responsible for building and modernizing hospitals across BC. I note that it's interesting it talks about building. I don't recall, I may have just missed it, whether they promised to build new hospitals. They may have talked about another one for sure.
They promised a couple, I think, during the campaign.
He'll also be trying to make prescription contraceptives free for everyone and fighting for a national pharmacare plan. Now, here's an area where health is a very provincial jurisdiction, and rolling out a provincial pharmacare plan that then you get money from the feds to help fund and run, you could just do. Like, that's how Tommy Douglas made the Medicare system work. He did it in Saskatchewan, and then eventually the feds bought in. It makes sense to do it nationally if you can, but it's another area like the drug decriminalization where if the feds are still dragging their feet, eventually just start doing something.
Well,
not just talking about it.
It makes a lot more sense than the decriminalization thing, because this is actually a very clear-cut provincial responsibility. And I could see if you're going to introduce pharmacare, there's some benefit to doing it nationally, but there's been an absolute fixation on that seems at best counterproductive, or at best not a great allocation of resources in terms of advocacy and trying to political capital, and at worst just counterproductive when this is very clearly a provincial responsibility, and there are, I think, more relevant participants at the provincial level in several provinces. So it's always made me scratch my head why there's so much emphasis on going federally from the advocates.
You mentioned at the top, the one federal MP who jumped to provincial politics who was appointed to full cabinet, and that was Murray Rankin, the new MP for Oak Bay Gordon Head. He's named the Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation, which fits some of the work he's done for the government, again, with the Wet'suwet and other communities. Ravi Kalon was promoted to a full minister as the new Minister of Jobs, Economic Recovery and Innovation. Standard stuff in his mandate letter, advancing clean BC jobs as part of the recovery. Big focus on shipbuilding, aerospace, and forestry, I noticed, as industries to really flesh out, especially the like mass timber strategies.
Yeah, several of those feel really like 70s through 90s NDP in the sense that they're very traditional kind of unionized labor sort of industries.
We still do have shipbuilding docks in this province, so that's worth focusing on. I don't know how big our aerospace industry is. I didn't know we really had one.
There's what, Viking Air out of Victoria that makes Twin Otters? And then there's a few. They bid on the Fitzwilliam SAR contract, but lost out on that a couple years back. But there are there's at least one small airplane manufacturer in the province, and I think several other parts manufacturers. But yeah, it's relative, compared to some other places, it's nowhere near Washington State's aerospace industry.
Harry Baines stays as the Minister of Labor. I was interested to see whether he would be assigned with implementing car check legislation explicitly. That was not in the platform, but he is going to, quote, ensure that every worker has the right to join a union and bargain for fair working conditions, which smells a bit like they might tweak union certification rules now that the Greens aren't, or at least Andrew Weaver isn't holding them back?
It does. Yeah, it does feel like a not explicit, but more of an implicit direction to go that way, which will no doubt be controversial when it rolls around.
Sheila Malcolmson is the new Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, and we've talked about what she'll be doing, largely continuing on what has been done by the NDP in that role. The new Minister of Municipal Affairs is Josie Osborne, who I believe was the former mayor of
Tofino. She was the mayor of Tofino, and there's now going to be a by-election to fill.
Huh. When she was first elected, she was Canada's only Green Party-affiliated mayor. She switched parties at some point.
Oh, I did not know that she had that background.
So it'll be interesting to see what she does, especially as a small town mayor, relative to Robinson, who represented Coquitlam, which is one of the larger Metro Vancouver communities, at least on the outskirts and growing. That's in her plot, in her mandate, is, as you'd expect, including supporting communities through COVID. Interestingly, she has been tasked with streamlining foreign credentials for regulatory and health-related colleges, which seems like it has nothing to do with municipal affairs to me.
Yeah, I noticed that too. It felt like it should be more like labor or advanced education or any of those ones.
Like one of those things that I'm pretty in favor of them doing a lot of work on, because a lot of people who immigrate to Canada have trouble getting jobs in the trade that they're educated for.
Yeah, it's not really seem like a municipal affairs issue, though. It feels really out of place in that particular mandate letter.
And her background is in marine biology and resource management.
So not exactly someone who has experience navigating kind of the health-related colleges either. It just feels weird on that one. Yeah, as mentioned on when we were talking about housing earlier, she'll be working with Evie on streamlining a lot of the approvals issues and modernizing that, which is good. And I believe she's been fairly outspoken in the past on kind of that more pro housing outlook, which is good. So not a bad choice there. Moving on to public safety and Solicitor General, Mike Farnworth stays in the post. Largely what you'd expect. ICBC reforms got handed back to him. In addition, they're looking to make permanent a bunch of the rules around liquor that got brought in as the pandemic hit as temporary measures, and now to make them permanent, such as the being able to wholesale purchase alcohol for restaurants and pubs, which for some crazy reason wasn't already a thing here, as well as allowing liquor delivery with takeout. Yeah, nice kind of slight rollback of 1920s era prohibition stuff that just makes a lot of sense. Good to see that. Everything else is more or less continuing on as before. There wasn't really anything that stood out as a departure from pre-election NDP.
Yeah, he's going to continue the Police Act review and implement the recommendations of it and whatever comes out of this anti-racism initiative that falls within his portfolio. At the same time, he also has to, quote, work with police to address serious crime and make the streets safe from gangs and guns. It does talk about introducing new legislation around sharing for law enforcement agencies, regulating imitation firearms, and strengthening the regulation of shooting ranges. I don't recall the NDP campaigning in the election on any gun laws, and gun laws are generally done at the federal level. So it's interesting to see some of those squeezed in here. I don't know that any are.
Yeah, there's probably like some land use rules about firearms ranges, but for the most part, firearms laws are federal. So it's a little weird to see included there.
Nicholas Simons from Powell River becomes the new Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction with Shane Simpson's retirement. Simons was not in the last cabinet, so I'm happy to see him here. I actually like Simons as an MLA. Not a lot of surprising stuff in his platform, continuing to advance the poverty reduction plan, but also working in the recommendations that are to come from the basic income panel. He's going to be the one responsible for bringing in accessibility legislation early next year and has to create a period poverty task force. So there'll be some interesting legislation and next steps coming from him. If BC gets a basic income, you can thank Nick Simons for it, I guess. I also like to see that there's an entire parliamentary secretary for accessibility, Dan Coulter, as well as one for community development and nonprofits, that's Nikki Sharma. Because I work for a nonprofit, it's nice to see the government recognize that sector. And because I have a sibling with a disability, making the province more accessible is always a good thing, and having a specific focus on there.
My MP, Melanie Mark, Tourism, Arts, Culture, and Sport. And Bob Dedith is the Parliamentary Secretary for Arts and Films. I thought there's really much in there that stood out or is worth commenting on.
I think she will have her work cut out for her, given how much those sectors have been decimated by the pandemic.
Yeah, a lot of that's really just, there isn't much you can do except kind of keep it on life support with help from finance. And then when we get a vaccine, a lot of that stuff will probably come roaring back pretty quick.
And I believe she's the only Indigenous person who was appointed as a minister. So she'll, I believe she's had a strong background in promoting reconciliation and Indigenous decolonization across government. So it'll be interesting to see how she can work that in with tourism, arts, culture, and sport across the province. And finally, as mentioned previously a couple times, Rob Fleming's the new Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure, and Bowen Ma, the Minister of State for Infrastructure. I think we've talked about most of the things that are in these two's wheelhouse. One notable one I saw in Rob Fleming's portfolio or mandate letter is to streamline effectively RFPs to get better deals for procurement for BC.
Also, just to make it much less of a hassle to go through the whole process. Yeah, it's a good thing. It's not, it's only going to be really, I think, seen on the background and a lot, but yeah, large government RFPs, requests for proposals, basically bids. Some streamlining there would not be a bad thing. So good to see there.
Otherwise, expand kind of everything. The South Island transportation strategy, expand BC Bus North, expand BC Ferry, or improve BC Ferry service at peak times. There's a goal of doubling active transportation, that's walking, biking, etc., trips by 2030 across the province. So a lot of sustainable green transportation stuff is going to be coming through.
The other thing I noticed was integrate TransLink and BC Transit. So I'm wondering if that is basically going to result in, you know, being able to like do a single fare from Abbotsford into Vancouver on the transit system, rather than having to, I think, change and at the edge of the Metro Vancouver onto a different bus system and come through. And who knows, maybe we'll have Compass cards province-wide that can be used for everything. Wouldn't be too bad.
Bowen Ma is going to be responsible for widening Highway 1 all the way out to Whatcom Road, as well as dealing with the Massey Crossing by supporting communities on both sides.
It's a little vague.
So she also has to finish the Patello Bridge replacement project, and that one is just ensure the successful completion. So in one, it's just build the new bridge. Patello's being done. On the other, it's get the support of the local communities to replace the Massey Crossing. It's a lot more caged, and so we're going to replace the Massey Tunnel because it needs replaced, but we don't know how to do it yet because we don't want to build that giant bridge the BC Liberals proposed, which was overkill.
This is, I'm kind of not thrilled about the press, but even just a slightly smaller bridge either, which may be more politics than anything else.
So that covers off pretty much everyone in council and everything that stood out. The other thing that stood out to me is the people who weren't in cabinet or named to parliamentary secretary. One of the most notable possibly is former cabinet member Ginny Sims, who had a few scandals in the last, one of the few cabinet members in the first Horgan government with any black marks, a few investigations behind her. I think she briefly left caucus when the RCMP were investigating her. Ginny Sims is not in cabinet at all. She'll be in the backbench. As well, Aman Singh, who is the star candidate in Richmond, Queensborough, who had been flagged as an up-and-coming lawyer in the party and someone who could be somewhere. It wasn't clear where exactly he could land, but to not get anything, I'm sure he'll still be a good voice in caucus, but there were some new MLAs who were appointed right to cabinet, but I'll be interested to see what he accomplishes through his time. And if we cross the party bench, there was some more news on the BC Liberal front this past week. You and Stuart talked a little bit about some of the criticism that had erupted within the BC Liberal Party over allegations of rampant sexism and descriptions of Andrew Wilkinson's behavior as just a sexist bully is what Rob Shaw's headline in the Vancouver Sun read. Following that on, I think it was Saturday, Andrew Wilkinson posted to Facebook that he was effective immediately resigning as leader and welcoming whoever would be appointed as the interim leader as soon as they could find one.
And earlier this week, they did find one as Shirley Bond was appointed interim leader. So she is long-serving MLA, first elected in 2001, comes from the interior of the province.
Prince George Valemont, way up north.
Held a few different ministerial jobs in the past, so like party stalwart, isn't likely to upset too much. But as the leadership process goes on, there's always a case where people get excited about the prospect of what a interim leader means and almost always read too much into it. I think there's is very unlikely Shirley Bond's going to do anything to change the direction of the party, but will, you know, probably competently hold it together and do a decent job of providing Her Majesty's loyal opposition to whatever the NDP wants to do over the next year until the permanent leader's in place.
Yeah, I get the sense Bond is pretty well respected on both sides of the aisle. She's been around long enough. I don't think there's ever been any knives out for her, so probably a pretty solid choice. I think the high water mark for interim leaders of parties is Rona Ambrose. And
yeah, no, she's literally the only interim leader that comes to mind as being particularly distinguished in there. Bob Ray did not a bad job, I think, post Ignatieff, but even, yeah, no, yeah, I agree. Rona Ambrose is the high water mark there.
But the next step is to find out what the BC Liberal leadership race will look like. I'm sure they'll roll out their plans in the next few weeks. The throne speech is coming on the 7th.
The Liberal Constitution requires, I believe it's within 1 year. So by next November, there will be a new leader in place.
So we'll stay tuned for all of that and to see how this new cabinet takes shape and what they set as their agenda in a couple of weeks.
Well, moving on to quick takes. One of the things the new Minister of Education is going to have to figure out is what to do about the Chilliwack School Board, because frequent person of controversy, school trustee Barry Neufeld, is once again in the news.
This time he is in trouble for referring to a couple or local reporters of one of the Chilliwack newspapers as he used the R word. He didn't apologize for that. And people again went, wow, why is this guy representing our children? The board has already removed his ability from attending school board events involving students or staff, and he has been banned from in-camera meetings of the school board. But as far as I can tell, they can't fire him, and neither can the Minister of Education. And so the question has come up, what do you do? And it seems like you can just fire the entire board is the nuclear option.
Yes, this was famously done in the final days of the Liberal government with the Vancouver School Board, and could be done here again, and they're allowed to appoint new trustees afterwards. So it is in theory possible that they fire the whole board and reappoint all but one of them. Although no doubt that would probably cause some lawsuits arguing that that in effect would just be the same as firing a single trustee. So might cause a little tail risk on that one, but yeah, it would address the problem right away.
I saw a recent headline, and then I'll move on, where it sounds like a very similar type of trustee in New Jersey who had a history of making homophobic comments recently resigned from their school board. But that was after this trustee had accidentally brought their laptop with them on a Zoom call into the bathroom to take a poop, and they hadn't turned their camera off. And so it was the, you know, the poop Zoom that cost that person their job, and not the, and that's what they resigned over, and not the homophobia. Do we have to see Barry Neufeld poop to get him off?
I'm actually surprised we haven't seen more people lose jobs for Zoom faux pas of various kinds. There's only been a couple actually like high profile ones after 8-9 months.
I think there were only two MLAs in the cabinet swearing in, because I did watch the whole thing, who forgot to unmute themselves. One was Melanie Mark, and I forget who the first one was.
Yeah, that's fairly minor. Definitely much less kind of cringy than that Vulcan salute thing the premier did.
Well, and the final story tonight, while we're on homophobic comments, is a major report that has been published about the RCMP by a former Supreme Court Justice, Michelle Bastarache. Bastarache? Someone else can correct me on that. Basically, he was appointed to do an inquiry on the RCMP following what was called the Merlo-Davidson settlement of women who had experienced sexual harassment and gender, or gender and sexual orientation discrimination while working for the RCMP. He, over 4 years, interviewed 640 different people who had worked with the RCMP to independently assess the claims, and came to the conclusion that the level of violence and sexual assault that was reported was shocking. What women told the assessors shocked them to their core. This process has forever tarnished the image of the RCMP as a Canadian icon. It's a big story that I think got missed. Even as I reviewed this, I was like, oh yeah, this is a big thing.
Yeah, it is.
Some of these claims date back to the 70s. I guess in 2016, the Liberal government had set aside $100 million to settle claims as they came forward, and they expected about 1,000 claims against the RCMP to come forward. Instead, over 3,000 claims were brought to the government. 2,300 were paid out, the rest were dismissed, and it cost the federal government over $125 million to settle with all of these claimants. The justice concludes in his report, "It's time to discuss the need to make a fundamental change to the RCMP and federal policing. He's of the opinion that culture change is highly unlikely to come from within the RCMP. The latter has had many years to proceed, has been the subject of numerous reports and recommendations, and has yet been yet unacceptable behavior continues to occur." He lists a number of recommendations. He calls for an external review. The RCMP Chief Commissioner Brenda Luckey is cool on the idea of an external review, which kind of goes to the point that an unwillingness to be accountable is a core issue in Canadian policing right now. And hopefully the Justice Minister federally, and or hopefully the Federal Public Safety Minister, reads this report and does something with it, because damn, the RCMP is a problematic institution from its like core out. And like little tweaks around the sides, little training courses aren't going to be sufficient to fix what is clearly a deep-seated problem here.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.